Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nicholson Baker's anthologist, poet protagonist in his latest novel, knows how to crack the whip of language. Ezra Pound, a blustering bigot, he says. U.S. Poet Laureate Billy Collins, a charming, chirping crack whore. Mostly, Baker's anthologist does very little, but he thinks marvelously about poetry, about rhythm and rhyme and meter and the meaning of it all. Nicholson Baker has cast his eye on phone sex and assassination and World War II, now poetry. This hour, On Point, Nicholson Baker and his new novel, The Anthologist. You can join the conversation. Are you a Nicholson Baker fan? Will you follow him into the world of meter and rhyme? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Portland, Maine, is Nicholson Baker. He's written 7 previous novels with his precise and playful stream of conscious style and 4 works of nonfiction. Vox looks at phone sex, Checkpoint at assassination. Human Smoke controversially cast Churchill and FDR as World War II aggressors. His new novel is The Anthologist. Nicholson Baker, welcome. Thanks very much for being here.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here, Tom. Thanks.
Well, this is a tremendous amount of fun. I was reading this book on a porch up in the White Mountains. A bear strolled by. It was all poetry between the pages and animal excitement out in the woods. This is really great. Once again, you don't make a lot happen, but you have a lot of fun with not a lot happening.
Well, thanks. I wrote the book by sitting around different places in our yard and trying to figure out what I actually knew about poetry. You know, you can write about poetry 2 ways. You can either prepare madly and get a lot of things queued up to say,
yes,
or you can take a white plastic chair and walk down to the creek and actually put it in the creek and sit down in it and find out what you want to say at that moment. So I try to do the second route.
Well, that is one path to research. It works pretty well here. You channel all that through your protagonist, Paul Chowder. He's a kind of second-tier American poet. He's collected a bunch of poems that rhyme, only rhyme. It's called in an anthology. He's struggling to write the introduction to it. Just can't get it done. And give us a little sense of all the things he does instead, Nicholson.
Well, he's Paul. Excuse me. Paul Chowder is really a lot like me in my in writing habits, and I've had to write introductions. I don't know. There's a particularly difficult thing about writing an introduction because you have to kind of sum up the book that comes after. You have to be a kind of master of ceremonies or a host. Mm. And I find it extremely difficult, and I've had terrible times. And my wife has said things like, just go up in the barn and write it. Just write it. You want to write it. I want you to write it. Your editor. So the kind of knots that Paul, is tying himself into are the kind of knots that I've tied myself into.
He's tracking, yes, motes of dust in beams of light and singing to himself endlessly. And I mean, any tiny distraction he can come up with, he mines to the end of the earth.
Because because that's where you have to, if you're going to think about anything, you have to think about it somewhere. You have to be sitting somewhere or walking somewhere. And I'm always interested in what's going on around the thought. The thought is if the thought is interesting, it's sometimes got an argument, it's got a series of bullet points. But the person is somewhere. And when I go to a poetry reading, the parts I like best are the parts where the poet says, "Well, I wrote this book because I was driving down Route 95 right, and coffee spilled in my lap," yeah, or something. And then I think, oh, okay, now I can listen to the poem. So, and then the poem starts, and I think, oh, gosh, that's a poem. I mean, that's hard to listen to, and my knee is fidgeting.
Tell me more of the backstory.
Yeah. So this anthologist is all what does Kant call it, prolegomenon? Anyway, it's all prologue.
He's so much prologue that his girlfriend has walked out on him, Roz. She's had enough of this procrastination, just can't take it anymore. And he's thinking about how in poetry, rhyme itself is a way that poets almost are forced
forward. You put out something, and then you need the rhyme. You have him saying, you posit a pling, and you want a fring. You propose a plong, and you want a frong. You're in suspense. You're solving a puzzle. He's almost longing to be doing that instead of writing an introduction.
Yes. Well, his problem is that he is a free verse poet, and he has always done that, and he likes poems that don't rhyme, but he has this deep suspicion that it's all wrong, you know, that his life has been a mistake, and that the real poets, the poets of the old anthologies, are sort of the soul of poetry. And he looks back at people like Auden and Louise Bogan and Robert Frost, and what they do, and a lot of them are depressed people. I mean, the strange thing about poetry is this close correlation between a kind of depressive streak, really depressive in the case of great poets like Edna St. Vincent Millay, beautiful poems, Sarah Teasdale, terribly sad, sad people. And so what does rhyme help them do? Well, they have a canyon of despair stretching out in front of them. And they have, in a sense, a fly-fishing line of a rhyme. They cast it out. They say, dance or day or something. They have a beautiful line that ends with that word. And suddenly they're in a state of suspense because they have to come up with something piercingly true, shockingly nice, you know, crazily funny or strange that will end with a word that chimes with that first word. So they're helped through. And if they're doing a sonnet or something, they have a whole elaborate architecture on which to kind of distract themselves from the pain that they are otherwise facing head on.
It's a scaffolding for the reader. It saves them that thin fishing line over that canyon of their despair. You say poetry is a controlled refinement of sobbing. And here you've got your poet, Paul Chowder, saying, I always secretly want it to rhyme. Could you read a little bit for us, Nicholson Baker?
Yes. Well, the poor guy, I mean, he does have this problem. I have this problem. I was in college, and I was an English major, and I read a lot of rhyming poetry, and it was one of the great disappointments of my life to realize that I didn't have that strange part of your brain. We don't even know where it is that allows rhyme to happen without sitting there going, rhyme, fame, flame, game, flame, fame. You know? So he says, I always secretly want it to rhyme. Don't you, some of you? Admit it. You open the latest issue of a magazine. Could be Harper's, could be The Atlantic, or the New York Review of Books, or The New Yorker, or the TLS, or some swanky literary magazine. You locate the poem, because you're naturally curious to see what this week's or month's trawl is, what it is that was in the busy mind of the poetry editor, most pressingly deserving of publication, and you look at the poem. There it is. You take in the title, Way Too Much. Way Too Much. Okay. And then you check the name of the writer. Squeef Corn Toasty. Never heard of him. Or I sure have seen Squeef Corn Toasty's name popping up in a lot of places lately. Or if it says, translated from the Czech by Bigelow Jones, forget it. You instantly move on because translations are never good. Well, wait, that's not fair. That's ridiculously unfair. I've read some wonderful translations. Translations of Tranströmer, for instance. But my heart does droop when I see that it's a translation. But let's say this poem is 100% original work. How are you going to approach it? How about we just sort of touch the first line? Just a glance. Take it in, guardedly, without really reading it. Maybe just the first phrase. I try to sit up straight. And then you break away to go down the words on the right-hand side, right down the outer edge. Pain, truffle, start, shelter, Anne, and bell. Now you know. It doesn't rhyme. Once again, they've done it. They've stabbed me right in the goddamned lung. Once again, they've rejected the whole 5-6 centuries of our glorious tradition. But all right, that's fine. It's a plum, not a poem. That's what I call a poem that doesn't rhyme. It's a plum.
I just love this. Nicholson Baker, reading from The Anthologist, and his Paul Chowder, the poet, there, wishing for rhyme, though he doesn't do it himself. Centuries of tradition, but you've got him reminding us right in the book, Nick. John Dryden, John Milton fought over rhyming way back when. Milton said it was barbarous to rhyme.
Oh, yes. This is a controversy. They've had several major explosions and started right sort of in the center of English poetry in the Elizabethan era. Thomas Campion, who was a masterful rhymer and a lute song singer. I mean, a lot of what we think of as
lute
poetry.
Lute is L-U-T-E.
Yes. Mm. What we think of as poetry began as song lyrics, you know, and this guy was a song lyric writer of great genius. And then suddenly he had a revelation one day, woke up in the morning and said, well, rhyme is overstrains the poet and forces him to say things that he doesn't want to say. And it's bad. And we should all write in these things that are sort of like Latin hexameters. And then people, especially this one great guy named Samuel Daniel, said, no, this is wrong. I have to stand up and defend rhyme. And he did it eloquently. So that happened. And then another 100 years go by. Well, actually, more like 60, 70 years go by. And then it happens all over again, this tension between rhyme and unrhyme. And people come to the defense of rhyme and say, no, it's great stuff. You've got to have it. It helps you pull. It pulls the poet's mind to an interesting, happier flight. And then we simmer, and then we come to the 20th century, and that's where it all really goes to hell.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist and writer Nicholson Baker. His new novel is The Anthologist. It's about poetry and rhyme and the writing life. It's wonderfully illuminating, and it is funny. He joins us from Portland, Maine. Of course, he's the author of Vox, of Human Smoke, The Fermata, The Everlasting Story of Nori, Checkpoint, and many more. Nicholson Baker, let's just get a little bit of that old-time religion here. Here's Yeats, William Butler Yeats, Nobel Prize winner, 1923, reading from his 1892 poem, The Lake Isle of Innisfree, and he's rhyming.
I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee-loud glade.
And on he goes. And Nick Baker, you've got your rhyme there. Innisfree and honey bee and wattles made and bee-loud glade. Are you happy? Is your Paul Chowder happy?
I'm very happy to listen to Yeats. I mean, it's not to say that I don't really, really love a whole lot of free verse poems, but the thing is that Yeats is a perfect example, and I'm glad you played that, because he comes on, I think in that same recording, he comes on in the beginning, at least in one of the versions I've heard, and he says, I'm going to read my poem in a very measured beat. And he does it, you know, because he, and if you listen to it, it's actually a good example of what is at the center of English poetry, because he says, I will rise and go now, rest, and go to Innisfree, rest. So what he's doing is reading a poem that has 4 beats to each line, okay? But the traditional kind of metrical way of treating that line is to say that it's got 3 stresses, because they don't hear the rest. I mean, they hear it. Part of them hears it, but part of them doesn't write it on the blackboard. So one of the idée fixe of my poet, Paul, and I have to shamefacedly say one of my own.
That's pretty clear.
Yeah. is that we've got to have this hidden beat, this secret empty shoe that's tapping away at the end of lines has to be acknowledged in poetry, or we don't really talk about it accurately. I will rise and go now, rest, and go to Innisfree, rest. You know, it's there. And if you try to say the poem without that thing, you're going to start walking around in that, you know, akimbo way that you do when you're out of rhythm.
And Paul is obsessed with this as he sits in the barn, not writing his introduction. And no, wherever he is, he's thinking about rhyme. He's thinking about meter here. He says people are going to feed you all kinds of oyster crackers about iambic pentameter. There's a wonderful reading I wish you'd give us on that front, Nick Baker. Could you set it up and take us in?
Yeah, so the oyster crackers, they're going to say, oh, ho, ho, iambic pentameter, the centrality of the five-stress line, because pent is five in Babylonian, and five is the number of fingers on your hand, and five is the number of slices of American cheese you can eat in one sitting. They're going to talk to you about Chaucer and about blank verse. Blank verse, which is another confusing term. And all this so-called prosody they're going to shovel at you. And sure, fine, you can handle it. You're up to whatever mind-forged shrivelments they're going to dish out that day. But just remember, A, that the word prosody isn't an appealing word, and B, that pentameter came later on. Pentameter is secondary. Pentameter is an import from France, and French is a whole different language. The real basis of English poetry is this walking rhythm right here. Oops, dropped my Sharpie. Right here. One, two, three, four. Plumskin, Ploshkin, Pelican, Jill, we think so then, we thought so still. I think that was the very first poem I heard, The Pelican Chorus by Edward Lear. My mom read it to me. God, it was beautiful. Still is. Those singing pelicans, they slapped their feet around on those long, bare islands of yellow sand, and they swapped their verb tenses so that then was still and still was then. They were the first to give me the shudder, the shiver, the grieving joy of true poetry, the feeling that something wasn't right, but it was all right that it wasn't right. In fact, it was better than if it had been right. In the middle of the night, Miss Clavel turns on the light, and on and on.
And on and on, and suddenly we're with Madeline in the middle of Nicholson Baker's The Anthologist, and that rhythm. As you have Paul Chowder, your poet, saying of the march, the work song, the love lyric, the ballad, the sea chanty, the nursery rhyme, the limerick. Now, all those with four beats. You've got threes and fours and fives in here. I have to admit, I got a little lost in the meter counting here.
Well, I think he gets
in love
lost
with many,
too.
Depending how he looks at them.
Well, I mean, the really great poems, when you hear them, they make sense. You can actually walk around to them often. Mm. What has this fancy name, iambic pentameter, is actually something that makes perfect sense if you hear it. So if you say, all human things are subject to decay, and when fate summons, monarchs must obey, that's technically iambic pentameter. You know, you and I hearing it just think, okay, well, that has a certain thump to it.
Of all that human hearts endure, the part which wars or kings can cause or cure.
Exactly. Okay, that's another iambic pentameter. That's one that, and these are, I think if you say them quickly, it's a distortion, but mm-hmm. you can almost hear what's happening. These are the great kind of the great 18th century lines, but how small of all that human hearts endure rest the part that wars or kings can cause or cure. All human things are subject to decay, rest, and when fate summons, monarchs must obey, rest. Now, if you conduct that mentally, you're going to go rum pa ta ta dun 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 rum. You're going to be in one, two, three. You're going to be in a kind of a minuet. And if you leave off that last beat, you're going to be in something that sounds like, you know, Gustav Holst's The Planets, Mars, the Bringer of War. You're going to say, all human things are subject to decay, right. And when fate summons, monarchs must.
Right.
You're going to play it like Yeats. Yeah. So the theory of meter actually turns out to be important because if writers look at the page and then write a poem, instead of listening to it, they may write poems that seem to fit the theory of meter, but don't actually fit what they know or what their ears know is true. And the same thing is true about Paul's theories about rhyme. He has a lot of theories about rhyme and why it is that we love it so much. And I don't know if he's right or not, but I put them down on the page because it seemed like the right thing to do.
It works pretty well. We've got a lot of listeners, Nicholson Baker, who want to join in. Let's go to Maria in Mansfield, Massachusetts. You're on the air with Nicholson Baker. Maria, hi.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
Good. I just want to first say this is the only radio station I listen to.
Bless you. What do you think about the poems?
Oh, boy. I tell you how I feel, because I've written poetry myself, and I've done it both ways, rhyme and not rhyme. And what I think is that if a writer, and Nick, you are totally amazing as far as all that you write about. You have such a variety of things that you write about, and I will really looking you up and reading that stuff. But the thing you had talked about earlier was rhyme and not rhyme. And as I said, I've done both. And rhyme, for me, it's more difficult than it is if I wrote poetry according to feelings and soul and stuff like that. So I think that when you can get a message across through rhyme, you're brilliant, because it doesn't always work. At least from my perspective, it doesn't always work.
But what about Milton's idea that it's barbaric, that it forces poets into ideas or patterns that they're...
I agree with that. I agree with
that too.
Yeah. I do. Yeah. I do agree with that. I'd rather write freely, just from my heart, from my soul, from my mind. And because if I have to start rhyming, I'm getting distracted. So I'd rather write through feeling, because poetry is to me both rhyme and non-rhyme.
There's the tension. What do you say, Nick Baker?
Well, I have to say that a whole lot of me agrees with that. And I tell a story in the book that's true of my own life, which is that I was sitting in fourth grade, and the teacher who I had a kind of crush on, and she said, we're going to learn something new today. She wrote free verse on the board in big capital letters, and she said, it's going to be this thing that's beautiful and strange and frightening and all the, and everything, and it's going to be art, and it doesn't have to rhyme. And something in me revolted, because I'd heard, all this Edward Lear and these great poets, Dr. Seuss, who rhymed like mad.
Right.
And I thought, no, it's poetry. It has to rhyme. But what my hero discovers when he tries to teach a class in college is that, first of all, that he's not a good teacher and that he just is a failure at that. But also that he finds himself saying to the students the exact same thing. It doesn't have to rhyme. Because really the number of people who can rhyme artfully and do something really heart-stoppingly beautiful is tiny. I mean, this art form is very inefficient. And if you allow people to write what they actually think in something that's kind of a densely figured prose that is short, that they call a poem, they might get more of what's true and funny and honest on the page than if you say to them, write me a sonnet or a villanelle, because they're not that way. And that's true, in fact, of my hero. He's not a rhyming guy, and yet he's had a certain amount of success as a writer of these things that he calls plums,
Not poems. They don't rhyme. And then he'll pick up a book and open to a certain page you write, and you read, up from the bronze I saw water without a flaw. Louise Bogen, Roman Fountain, and he's smitten again with rhyme.
Well, you have to love Louise Bogen. And I wanted, in a way, in writing this book to bring out the kind of working knowledge of poetry, the little loves that you have as a poet of bits and pieces of things, the fragments. Louise Bogen was the poetry reviewer for The New Yorker. She's not as well known as many poets now, but she was very funny. And she was a terrible depressive, and she had a kind of wonderful fling with a more famous poet, Theodore Retke.
Mm-hmm.
But after this fling, this lost weekend where they drank gallons of liquor and, she wrote this beautiful poem called Roman Fountain. Up from the bronze I saw water without a flaw rush to its rest in air, reach to its rest in fall. And it's got this amazing kind of triplety pulsing rhythm. I mean, I actually set it to music. I decided I love these little snippets so much. I went up into the barn for a couple of weeks, and I just sang them until I came up with tunes for them. And then I thought, well, I've done all this work. I might as well put the tunes in the novel.
I love that. You have Paul Chowder doing that. Do you have the tunes to mind? Can you deliver a little on that?
It's radio. Well, it's radio, but, you know, the voice box is not willing. I mean, let's see.
Come on.
Up from the bronze I saw water without a flaw rush to its rest in air, reach to its rest and fall. So it's just a kind of a...
Bless you. Yeah, we're in the barn with you, with Paul Chowder.
In the barn, of course, there's nobody there. You can really blast it, you know, and the birds kind of leap off the top of the roof.
I love it.
Because you're singing it loud, but I can't do that into a microphone.
Let's get a call from Lisa in Newton, Massachusetts. Lisa, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. After years of moderating debates amongst poets, I think this dichotomy between rhyme and not rhyme is really a false dichotomy. Rhyme is a tool in poetry, like any other tool, and it can be used well and it can be used poorly, but it doesn't necessarily have to be one definition of rhyme. Being an end rhyme metrical poem equals poem, and not rhyme equals something else.
Plum.
I love to use rhyme, but I tend to use it buried in the middle of lines, or I use near rhyme or slant rhyme, and I think that you can do that. You can break some of the rules of form and still come out with something that is a poem that uses rhyme.
Nick, I know your Paul Chowder wouldn't exactly argue with that. On the other hand, does he get the same joy from near and slant rhyme? Will he take it all?
Well, sure. I mean, he talks about the fact that the Zombie Jamboree song has this interesting... One of the points that he wants to make is that we're all stuffed with poetry. We don't even know it, but we've got hundreds and hundreds of things that we really should look at and think of as poems that have traditional end rhyme and stress patterns, and they're just called song lyrics. And so so we all have a head full of poetry in a sense. So, and yes, of course, and I think that a lot of free verse poets are people who, I mean, I think this is not unfair to say that, that my hero is standing on one side of the fence, and he's happy to be there. He's a free verse poet. Yeah. And he knows that there's certain things that you can do this way that you can't do if you have this kind of tyranny of having to rhyme in a certain way, the old-fashioned way. But he looks across the fence, you know, and it just looks green and beautiful and anthologized over there. And he thinks about that. So it's not that my book is trying to make any kind of conclusive argument. It's just trying to capture some of the yearning emotions that I think that poets feel on both sides. The difficulty when you're in the midst, say to yourself, okay, I'm going to write a sonnet, you know, and I'm going to really do it upright. And then halfway through, you have a thought that is just crushing and breaking and resisting the rhyme scheme that you have. Mm-hmm. And that's when you're on the other side of the fence looking at, and one of my favorite poets, W.S. Merwin, never rhymes. You can't memorize him. He's beautiful in this rhymeless, heavily, well, totally free verse state. He doesn't even use punctuation or capital letters. And you read these poems and you have to kind of do this decryption. You have to figure out where the sentences begin or end. That's part of the beauty of the poem.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with novelist and writer and clearly poetry lover Nicholson Baker. His new novel is The Anthologist. It's about poetry, rhyme, meter, the writing life. It's illuminating. It is funny. Let's hear a little more of that rhyming life. You mentioned Nick, Edna St. Vincent Millay, 1892, 1950, first woman to receive the Pulitzer Prize for poetry. Here she is reading from her 1921 poem, Recuerdo.
We were very tired. We were very merry. We had gone back and forth all night on the ferry. It was bare and bright and smelled like a stable. But we looked into a fire. We leaned across a stable. We lay on a hilltop underneath the moon, and the whistles kept blowing, and the dawn came soon.
You've got to love the raid, the way they read Jean Yates and Mary and Fairy and Moon and Soon, and then she's making no apologies right there.
Yeah, she's part of. She's still a part of that older tradition in the stage tradition, where you always rolled your R's on the vaudeville tradition. You know, we were very merry.
Yes.
I love that. She's in some ways a fairly important character in this book.
Yes.
because she is one of those tragic poets. She, in a sense, died on the stairs.
With that controlled refinement of sobbing having taken her as far as she got.
Yes, she's one of the best, the greatest poets of the 20th century. I mean, she had a little eclipse through her fame. She's completely back now. Everybody understands that she's brilliant. She is. She had a bad phase toward the end of her life. She was drinking a great deal, as she always did, but she also wrote all this propaganda poetry to sort of help along the war effort during World War II. And it
buck up.
And she, I think she regretted it, and it was not good poetry. Anyway, she fell down the stairs, and that's how she died. And my poet has an accident. Well, hell, why should I say it like that? I had an accident. I was carrying the computer down the stairs, and I misjudged the last step, and I had to kind of hustle forward, holding the computer like a mother chimp holding its baby underneath, and I crashed into the door jamb, and I thought I'd broken my finger, and I thought, oh, thank God, something has happened to me. I've got something to put in this book, because I wrote it sort of in a sustained burst. I had a lot of notes, but over a summer,
he has a fingertip to reattach suddenly. Something exciting.
Yes, that was another little mishap that happened to me.
Right.
You know, when you're in the middle of writing a book, it's strange how every tiny event develops this luminous quality. And you think almost that it was foreordained that this little finger incident happened. I had three finger incidents. And I thought, miraculous. This is great. I've got a theme.
Well, it works for you because of your stream of conscious stuff. I mean, anything can be brought in here practically, one way or another.
Well, the thing really is also you have to do a certain amount of messing around with it afterwards. I mean, I have enormous manuscripts, and then I play around with them. But it's true that I think when you know something, or when you pretend to know something, when I say, okay, here's my character, he's a poet, he has a head full of poetry, to some extent I do too, but he really does. How is he going to get that out? Well, it's because certain little events, moments, hook into him and pull out something from that day. So he falls down the stairs. He remembers that Vachel Lindsay, a poet, died sort of walking up the stairs, having drunken Lysol, and that Edna St. Vincent Millay has a fall down the stairs. So he pulls it together, because I think that's the way we actually think. Something happens, and that pulls a bit of what we know out. It's not good to start at the beginning. You have to start at whatever life pulls out from you.
Well, and you're Paul Chowder. You surely do. We have a lot of people who want to talk with you, Nicholson Baker. Lake Placid, New York. Brian, you're on the air with Nick Baker.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thanks.
Hi.
Good show. Hi, Nicholson. One of my favorite writers.
Thank you.
One of my favorite books that you've written is You and I, about John Updike. What I was thinking was, I think I saw him on Charlie Rose one time, and he was talking about how much he enjoyed the new poetry jams that have been around for a little while.
Jams and slams and all the rest, you know.
Yeah, well, what's lovely about Updike is that he's gracious and brilliantly intelligent and has this tremendous prose style and is open to all kinds of things that are not necessarily, don't fit with his own writing. He was very important to me as a beginning novelist because there he was. I mean, he was sort of at the top of the pyramid. He was the successful American writer. He made a living from his writing. You know, I wrote a book about. In some ways, it's similar to this book in that I decided that I would write the book about Updike without actually preparing. I would say, okay, what do I know? What can I remember? What phrases are in my mind already from the Updike reading I've done? And let's see what comes out if I just rely on that without rereading Updike from beginning to end. And this book is also, I tried to use knowledge that has moldered down. In fact, the way I wrote this book was to set up a video camera and sort of talk the things, and I would do it repeatedly until it was over-familiar, so that I was kind of doing an accelerated aging, in a way, of the of the material in my head, so that it was as if I had lived with it for a while.
That's a picture, because you in the barn with a video camera over and over?
In the barn, I actually set it up in the creek. Most adventurous thing.
You're not kidding, on the white plastic chair. Okay.
With the XLR cables going in the water and then coming up to the lavalier microphones. It was and there's a whole ritual. You know, set up something. As you set something up, you have to get into the mode of being semi-public. And that's a different thing than being a writer. So this is more of a spoken book, and a book that tries to be – so have the knowledge be – familiar and fragmentary rather than prepared for.
And what about, Brian asks, poetry jams, poetry slams, that whole huge carnival?
I think it's great. I mean, I quote some things. I mean, one of the questions is, what's happened to light verse? Why do we have no light verse in places like the New Yorker, used to publish Ogden Nesson? Well, those poetry jams are funny. I mean, you know, that's part of it, is that they are, in a sense, light first. What we don't know right now is what the great poets of our time are. We will have no knowledge of that. It may be somebody who is laboring in complete obscurity, and it may, in fact, be a song lyricist or somebody who writes a blog or something. We don't know. In 50 years, it's just over and over been true that the real singers, it takes some time for them to emerge. And so what my guy is thinking about is, he's at one point he's up on a ladder. He thinks of himself up on a ladder, and below him are all these poets struggling up behind him, and he's, you know, and it's cold, and he looks way up there, and there's Sarah Teasdale and, you know, I don't know, Jory Graham and all these famous people, Shakespeare. And he thinks, what if I just, you know, let go? It's this struggle. Every poet has to worry about it. Where am I on the ladder, you know? And it doesn't really matter.
Brian, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Chris in Plainville, Massachusetts. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks, Tom. I just want to say, I'm not a poet or anything like that. I haven't even thought about poetry since high school, really. I'm a musician. Sorry, I'm a little nervous. But what you were saying about rhythms and how they go along with poetry and everything, poetry is like pretty much essentially music. And for me, the rhythm itself is almost like poetry. Like, you could remove the words, and just the rhythms can be very beautiful and have meaning.
You're right on Nick Baker's page there, Chris. I have to say, Nick, you're right about, I mean, you know, you start with poetry, and pretty soon you've got Cole Porter and Gilbert and Sullivan and John Lennon and Paul Simon all in the mix here.
Yeah, I think you have to mush things together more than they are, because what happened, I mean, this is one thought, is that American pop music and movie musical music was so lushly rhymed, inner rhymes, external rhymes, so brilliantly clever with Irving Berlin and Dorothy Field and all those people that we think of as the great American songwriters, that it, in sense, that what was called traditional poetry had to find a new place for itself. And so it decided to be adamantly unrhyming and to establish itself as singing in a different way. I think that was and that was probably a good thing for poetry in the long run, but it meant that during the late 60s and the 70s, if you were a poet who actually just liked to write rhyming poems, you were in trouble. I mean, it was not something that was accepted in the academy. And really, rhythms, just being able to march around or stroll around while you say a poem is so important. A.E. Housman, who was one of the great, poets of 100 and some years ago, we would drink a couple beers and he would go for a walk. And as he was walking, he would write these four-beat lines. Well, they sounded the way that they did because he was taking a walk down a country road.
And we all know them, and you've got them. Where Alph, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to man, that four-beat walk running through, you name it, Coleridge, and right on.
Sure, but there are things that you have to look. I mean, you have to look closer. You have to take that magnifying glass out and say, what's in between the stresses? Are there triplets? Are there quadruplets? One of the things, the great sort of 19th century musical poem is Poe's Raven. Mm. And it has these fancy ways of describing it that you can read. It's lines 2 and 4, catalectic, octameter. It's got a lot of fancy technical words, but it's basically, of the human, it actually is a guy walking and having a sort of four-beat pulsing rhythm as he walks. God dang it. Now I've lost my memory of the poem. Oh my God.
It'll come.
But anyway,
I don't have that one at my fingertips here, though we would all know it if we did.
Here it goes. Yeah, now wait a minute. And the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain thrilled me, chilled me with fantastic terrors never felt before. All right. So it's really still four. But it's if you're putting a magnifying glass, you're seeing the little creatures in there. The little tiny quadruplet creatures are in there.
It's wonderful. Edgar Allan Poe right there in The Raven. Priscilla in Newton, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Priscilla.
Yes, I'm calling because I speak several languages, and I'm realizing how language has lost so much of the power to elevate thought. And in a very technological, reportorial world, how much of value it can be to actually resuscitate the power of poetry in language again. And I thought I would definitely say this in terms of how this new generation has to relearn the resonance of language again, and how poetry, and I am so grateful, Tom, that your program includes the power of language, is increasingly important for our civilization around the world. And I'm just talking West, but the globalized culture that we have become, to recapture the kind of language that elevates the spirit, that is more than just stuff.
That holds us up. But Priscilla, you're right on Nicholson Baker theme here with his Paul Chowder and the Anthologist. Nick, I mean, you've got him musing over the crumbling of the English language as a possibility and all that might come with that.
Well, one of the great compliments that reviewers of the 19th century would say was that such and such a poet or novelist will last as long as the language will last. And that just pulls at me because you have to ask how long any language will last. It's not that I don't personally think that we are in a state of end times or terminal language decay. In fact, on the contrary, it seems as if we've got all this new vocabulary that's just bubbling up and nourishing things, and we've got new ways of singing every day.
Even with Twitter speak and techno speak and you name it, that has Priscilla a little concern?
Well, it's it nourishes in the long run in the sense that it pushes things around. It's like those, you know, it's like the energy flows coming up to the surface of the sun. The other bits of thermonuclear activity have to kind of move and accept and digest and make sense of. So, but I think that even though it's true that probably English will decay and crumble the way, say, Latin did and become an academic language, that we just have to, in some ways, not think about that and just listen and think and respond to the beauty of a line now and not worry about it. And I'm just saying that because I used to worry about it. What happens if English is no longer the powerful world historical language that it is? It doesn't matter. There were times when Dutch was an extremely important language, and languages come and go, and each of them kind of has their own beauties, and often they have similar rhythms, and we just should, go with the flow, I think.
We'll give it to the rhyming Rudyard Kipling here, and what is art whereto we press through paint and prose and rhyme when nature in her nakedness defeats us every time? Just one of many wonderful bits from Nicholson Baker's new book, The Anthologist. We will we'll go out picturing you in your white plastic chair in the creek, Nick Baker. That's wonderful. Thanks for the book. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, you can read an excerpt from The Anthologist at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.